This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, how Palestinians made history in Bab al-Shams, a village established on private Palestinian land in a direct action against Israel's settlement enterprise in the West Bank. Also, Israeli forces kill four young Palestinians in 1 week in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. A new study by Palestinian human rights and advocacy group Badil reveals that Palestinian refugee services are slashed despite ongoing displacement. We'll have an interview with Amjad Al-Qassas, Badil's legal advocacy coordinator in Bethlehem.
We're talking about a huge number of Palestinians who are still deprived from their basic rights, the basic right of any refugee to return to his or her home or place of origin. And we have to recall that within the last 65 years, not a single Palestinian refugee or internally displaced person could ever return to his or her home or place of origin.
Settlement firms don't benefit Palestinians, says a new study. And news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, including Veolia Water withdrawing its bid on a contract in Northern California following sustained BDS campaigning, and SodaStream's Super Bowl ad gets spoofed by activists. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. We begin in the occupied West Bank. On Friday, January 11th, a group of Palestinian activists established a village in the West Bank called Bab el-Shams, Arabic for Gate of the Sun. The name is in reference to Palestinian novelist Elias Khoury's book of the same name. The village was established on private Palestinian land that has been confiscated by Israel. Israel has termed the area E1, and through that area, it plans to connect blocks of illegal settlement colonies east of Jerusalem. Establishing Bab el-Shams was a direct action against the impending settlement expansion and against Israel's overall settlement enterprise itself. Late Saturday night, January 12th, hundreds of Israeli soldiers and border police encircled the village and invaded it, pulling down tents and arresting all of the people in the village. The Electronic Intifada contributor Abbas Sarsour was part of the activist group in the village. Sarsour reported, quote, "As the population grew in size, so did the imminent threat of an Israeli raid designed to stop all activity in Bab el-Shams. At 11 p.m. on Saturday, more than 500 Israeli forces, soldiers and police, surrounded the village. We could see them approaching from all sides as they aimed their bright lights at us. The armed Israeli forces climbed the hillside up to us and completely encircled us. They were ordering us to leave. Many of the activists tied themselves to the tents. Others put their hands together and sat down in the middle of the small village while chanting." Sarsour added, quote, "We were outnumbered. Plus, we could see the soldiers burning various items in the village. Soon enough, the Israeli forces began their assault on us specifically. Everyone in the village was rounded up and arrested. Many were hit with the butts of Israeli weapons. Others, including myself, were dragged through the sand and dirt and thrown back onto buses." The activists were dropped off at the Kalandia checkpoint between Jerusalem and Ramallah. The Electronic Intifada's contributor Max Blumenthal reported on Monday that, quote, "Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is clearly troubled by the establishment of Bab el-Shams, a Palestinian protest village erected on privately owned Palestinian land, the planned route of what Israel calls the E1 corridor in the occupied West Bank. The E1 area was to be the capstone of Israel's settler colonial enterprise, a long segment of housing units expanding east from the Jews-only mega-settlement of Male Adumim, permanently severing East Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank and virtually slicing the West Bank in half. And now 400 Palestinians and their supporters stood directly in the way of the plan." Blumenthal added that Netanyahu sent a lawyer to the Israeli High Court demanding the immediate eviction of Bab el-Shams. The High Court issued a temporary injunction, quote, "preventing its eviction for 6 days pending further deliberations." Nevertheless, in violation of the court order, Israeli forces stormed the village anyway and forcibly evicted the activists. The Israeli police also banned journalists from entering the village, but for those who managed to find a back way inside, Israeli forces attacked the journalists during the eviction and arrest of the Palestinians who had established Bab el-Shams. Following the initial arrest and eviction of activists at Bab el-Shams, Palestinians returned to the village and rebuilt the tents. But on Wednesday, the Israeli High Court rescinded its injunction and issued an order that allows Israeli forces to bulldoze and take down the tents. Man News reported that Israeli soldiers placed cement blocks on the roads, sealing the entrances to the village. Man added that on Wednesday evening, the Israeli army returned with bulldozers, quote, several military vehicles and dozens of settlers who raided the village and tore down the tents. Palestinians say that they will continue to return to Bab el-Shams. For much more of our coverage of Bab el-Shams, visit electronicintifada.net. Between January 11th and January 15th, four young Palestinians between the ages of 17 and 22 were shot dead by Israeli occupation forces. On January 11th, 22-year-old Anwar Mamlouk was gunned down by Israeli soldiers near the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza. On January 12th, 21-year-old Odai Darwish was shot and killed while crossing Israel's wall in the West Bank in order to get to work in Israel. Writing in an op-ed, our contributor Charlotte Silver reported that, quote, initially Israeli sources claimed the soldiers shot al-Darwish in his legs, in accordance with the so-called rules of engagement. But medical sources quickly revealed that he was hit in the back, indicating that he was likely shot while trying to run to safety. Silver added that a 21-year-old farmer from Beit Lahia in the Gaza Strip was shot in the head by an Israeli sniper on January 14th while he was farming his land. And then on the same day, Samir Awad, a 17-year-old from Budrus, a West Bank village located near Ramallah, was shot from behind in the head, torso, and leg while running away from soldiers, Silver reported. Quote, Samir had just completed his last exam before school break and had joined a group of boys to protest the wall. Samir's family has lost 5 acres of land with 3,000 olive trees due to the construction of Israel's wall. Samir had also been jailed 3 times for his participation in demonstrations. Silver's op-ed also analyzes the scant, if not outright omittance, of reports of these killings in the Western media. She writes, quote, The New York Times took the murder of Samir Awad, the fourth in a spate of Israeli willful killings of unarmed Palestinians, as an opportunity to remark on the, quote, growing unrest in the West Bank, bizarrely shifting culpability for the deaths onto Palestinians. It must be noted that when 17-year-old Mohammed al-Salaima was slain by a border police officer in Hebron on his birthday in December 2012, the New York Times remained silent, end quote. For more on the killings this past week and to read more of Charlotte Silver's op-ed, go to electronicintifada.net. A new report has been published by Badil, the Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights based in Bethlehem. The report, titled Survey of Palestinian Refugees and Internally Displaced Persons 2010 to 2012, is the result of 10 years of research. The 128-page document by the Palestinian organization is a key resource for anyone wishing to understand the forces which made Palestinians the largest and most long-standing population of forcibly displaced persons in the world and the conditions in which they live today. Badil reports that at the end of 2011, there were at least 7.4 million displaced Palestinians, representing 66% of the entire Palestinian population worldwide, and that, quote, out of every 100 residents of the Gaza Strip, 58 are refugees, and out of every 100 residents of the West Bank, 42 are refugees. Because of ongoing forced displacement in the region, the Palestinian refugee population continues to grow. Badil's report addresses this issue while pointing out that there is no meaningful international effort to restore the rights of Palestinian refugees. Instead, the United Nations Agency for Refugees suffers a shortage of budget and thus has had to significantly reduce services. Joining us to talk about this new and very important report is Amjad Al-Qassas, the legal advocacy director at Badil, who is speaking to us from Bethlehem. Amjad, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you very much, Nora. It's my pleasure.
So first off, can you talk about the overview of this report on Palestinian refugees and internally displaced persons? It's a culmination of 10 years of research, and in it, you include information, statistics, data analysis about Palestinian refugees. You know, the vast majority were forced from their lands in 1948. We're talking about 5.8 million people. Then there's another 1 million Palestinians who were made refugees as a result of the 1967 war, and more than 500,000 Palestinians who are internally displaced on both sides of the Green Line. Talk about these populations and how, as Badil points out, the numbers are growing every year because of further ongoing displacement by Israel and regional unrest as well.
Yeah. First of all, this survey is Badil's seventh installment, so the seventh edition of our survey about Palestinian refugees and internally displaced persons. As you already said, we are looking at a growing number. So what is very important, if we talk about Palestinian refugees or internally displaced persons, that we not only look at something which happened in the past, like a historical fact. So we're not only talking about refugees from 1948 or 1967. We're also talking about refugees from 2013. So last year, 2012, witnessed the creation of new Palestinian refugees. And unfortunately, since the last 64 years, and even prior to that, there has been not 1 year passing without witnessing the creation of new Palestinian refugees. And in our survey, we try to update different numbers and statistics about the Palestinian refugees and internally displaced persons.
Amjad, if you could give us some examples of some of this research and maybe what was most surprising to you and the staff at Badil in gathering these numbers and these statistics.
Yeah, I mean, most surprisingly, in a way, the sad story behind it, that in 2012, when the survey was finalized, that we are still looking at 66% of the Palestinian people belonging to the group of refugees or internally displaced persons. So we're talking about a huge number of Palestinians who are still deprived from their basic rights, the basic right of any refugee to return to his or her home or place of origin. And we have to recall that within the last 65 years, not a single Palestinian refugee or internally displaced person could ever return to his or her home or place of origin, wherever this is located within the overall territory of Mandate Palestine. If you ask about specific numbers which were surprising to us, for the first time in the seventh installment of our survey, we included a chapter on opinion polls, where we have asked Palestinian refugees living in refugee camps in all UNRWA mandate areas about their satisfaction about UNRWA services which they get in refugee camps, which varies from health services, education, to other basic services people should have. And positively surprisingly, I want to say that 88% still consider UNRWA a vital part of their life and vitally important for upholding the rights of Palestinian refugees. Even 55%, so the majority of Palestinian refugees, regards UNRWA as a international agency which defends the rights of Palestinian refugees. This is surprisingly because UNRWA's mandate actually is exclusively focusing on humanitarian assistance. So it does actually not include protection. So it's surprisingly that for Palestinian refugees somehow it at least indirectly includes specific protection services.
And of course, UNRWA is the UN agency for refugees. Amjad, let's talk a little bit more about this. As you said, Palestinians have not been afforded the protections of other refugee groups worldwide, and agencies like the UN Agency for Refugees, UNRWA, has been systematically given less and less resources. Why is the Palestinian refugee issue so pushed under the rug and humanitarian assistance to refugees routinely given less and less resources and funding?
Yeah, this, of course, is a very important question, Nora. I mean, we have to start looking at the whole idea of actually limiting the question of Palestinian refugees to a humanitarian issue. the core problem of Palestinian refugees is actually this specific limitation. Palestinian refugees are a political issue, and therefore only a political solution could be the correct solution to this political issue. But it has been limited to a humanitarian issue. UNRWA in itself, created by the United Nations, has an exclusive mandate only to deal with Palestinian refugees as a humanitarian issue. So basically to keep Palestinian refugees alive. And UNRWA is doing this for more than six decades. But actually what is important in this discussion, that prior to UNRWA, the United Nations created another UN agency dealing exclusively with Palestinian refugees, UNCCP. And UNCCP was created to bring about a political solution to the political problem of Palestinian refugees. But unfortunately, after a few years of its existence, it more or less ceased to exist because UNCCP did not get any support on the political level to be able to implement its recommendations to bring about this political solution. And today, in 2013, on paper, UNCCP still exists, and it publishes every year a report within the United Nations. This report consists of one sentence, and this sentence is, there's nothing new to report. And this is the core issue. The problem of Palestinian refugees is the lack of political will within the international community. The international community, until now, simply lacks political will to bring about this political solution and wants to look at the question of Palestinian refugees through the lenses of a humanitarian crisis. But this is only treating the symptoms, but not the actual sickness. This is why UNRWA, as stated even by the general director of UNRWA, can never be the solution to the Palestinian refugees, because it, again, only treats the symptoms, but not the actual sickness.
And of course, the core issue here is the Palestinian right of return, which has been upheld and ratified by the United Nations every year since 1949. We're talking about UN Resolution 194. Can you talk about 194 and the Palestinian right of return in the context of peace agreements, so-called political negotiations? You know, how can we assess the continuing moves by Israel and some elements of the Palestinian Authority, for that matter, to completely and permanently reject the right of return for Palestinian refugees as a bargaining chip for so-called peace settlement?
Yeah, I firmly believe that there will be no long-lasting peace, and more importantly, no just peace without taking consideration the huge amount of Palestinian refugees. And as you said, the most important right of every refugee in the world, not only Palestinian refugees, is the right to return to one's home or place of origin. And in the case of Palestinian refugees, as you already said, has been confirmed and reconfirmed and reconfirmed that the Palestinian refugees as a group, as a collective group, have the right to return. Next to this collective right, as it is affirmed by numerous UN resolutions, individual Palestinian refugees have the individual right to return, like any other refugee worldwide. This means that in the end, every individual refugee has the right to return or not to return. However, this decision has to be laid upon every Palestinian refugee. No person, no state, no government even, not even a future Palestinian government could decide on the individual right of return of every Palestinian refugee. So every Palestinian refugee has the right to decide on this specific issue. And in order to be a decision, to actually take a decision on this important issue, the right to return has to be implemented in reality. And after it has been implemented, basically after it is actually possible for a Palestinian refugee to return, then the refugee can decide whether he or she wants to return or not to return. But this is a key issue. And in excluding it from the negotiation table, it actually means that there is no sincerity in actually bringing about a long-lasting and just peace in this overdue conflict.
That's the voice of Amjad Al-Qassas. He's with Badil, the Resource Center for Palestinian Refugees and Residency Rights, based in Bethlehem in the West Bank. Amjad, finally, the other report that Badil put out this week deals with Palestinian youth identity. Talk about that report and how it fits into the report on refugees and internally displaced persons.
Yes, we next to our overall survey on Palestinian refugees, we also published another report, a survey which is something like a complementary survey to our overall survey, which is titled One People United, a Badil survey of Palestinian youth. And it discusses two main issues, identity and importance of social ties. In order to understand why we conducted this survey, it's important to understand that when we deal with the issue of Palestinian refugees, we are dealing with a specific ideology, the ideology which is behind the forcible displacement of the Palestinian people. So when we talk about Palestinian refugees, again, just to recall, we are talking about Palestinian refugees which were created prior to 1948 and still ongoing to this very day. We at Badil are calling this the ongoing Nakba. The ongoing Nakba, which is targeting the Palestinian people, the indigenous population of this area in the world, of today, the OPT, Occupied Palestinian Territory, and Israel. And this ideology is basically aiming at forcibly displacing this indigenous population. And the important point is that this ideology is a colonial ideology which is using the classical colonial elements of divide and conquer. So for Israel, in order to conquer the territory of Palestine, it was important for Israel to first divide the Palestinian people into various different subdivisions. And today, in 2013, we are looking at five categories of Palestinians. The Palestinian people have been divided by the State of Israel throughout the last decades into five main categories. We are looking at the Palestinian citizens of Israel, the Palestinians who are today living in Israel. We are looking at the Palestinian so-called permanent residents of East Jerusalem, the Palestinians living in the West Bank who are carrying the West Bank identity card, the Palestinians in Gaza who are carrying the Gaza identity card, and the millions of Palestinians living in forced exile who are prevented from returning to their homes and places of origin. All those five categories, and this is important, are determined by the State of Israel. Even a child born here in the West Bank, here in Bethlehem, where I am now, born by Palestinian parents, in order for the child to get registered and to receive proper documents, these documents are issued by the Israeli military governor. Now, after Israel has basically divided the Palestinians into these five categories, it is trying to basically eliminate any kind of social ties between these five categories through simply geographically isolating these five areas and prohibiting inhabitants from these five different groups to meet and to establish social ties. So it was important for us to, in 2012, for the first time, to carry out a survey with Palestinian youth in the different areas where today the majority of Palestinians are living, which is Israel, the West Bank, including Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, where we have asked the youth between 15 and 19 years about their self-identification and the importance of social ties. And surprisingly for us, and very positive surprisingly, that still the majority of the Palestinian youth, and we are looking at the third or fourth generation after the original Nakba in 1948, still the vast majority of Palestinians consider themselves as Palestinians. So, for example, Palestinian refugees living for 64 years in Syria, in the host country of Syria, are still, the majority of them consider themselves as Palestinians and not as Syrians, for example. The most interesting number for us are actually the Palestinians living in Israel, because they are living under the direct policies and doctrine of erasure, where the state of Israel is trying to erase Palestinian identity from the Palestinians living in that state. And still, with all the pressure they have to endure, 34% of Palestinian youth today consider themselves as Palestinians, and only a slightly minority consider themselves as Israeli or Israeli Arab, as they are declared or categorized by the state of Israel. Also, and the question on social ties, the majority of Palestinians in all different areas consider it as important or even very important to establish and foster social ties with the Palestinians living in the other areas. And this is a very important survey, and important in a sense that it shows us, if we connect it to your previous question of the right to return, that today, after 64 years of the ongoing Nakba conducted and committed by the State of Israel, that still the Palestinian people, by large, consider themselves being part of one people, and therefore the solution has to be found in accordance with all those created subgroups of Palestinians. So there could be no solution, again, without taking in consideration the millions of Palestinian refugees living in forced exile, because even the Palestinians living here today in occupied Palestine consider themselves being part of one Palestinian people, which includes all the million Palestinians living today in forced exile.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it right there. That's the voice of Amjad Al-Qassis. He's the legal advocacy director with Badil, the Resource Center for Palestinian Residency and Refugee Rights in Bethlehem. For more on Badil's work and to read these very important reports that they just put out, visit badil.org, that's spelled B-A-D-I-L.org, or go to electronicintifada.net. Amjad, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast, and thank you for all the work you and Badil do.
Thank you very much, Nora.
A new report has been published by Who Profits, the research project of the Tel Aviv-based Coalition of Women for Peace, which takes a look at companies based in Israeli settlements and the various ways they attempt to justify profiting from the occupation and daily hardships suffered by Palestinians. The Electronic Intifada reported this week that, quote, settlement businesses profit from the occupation of Palestinian land and the exploitation of Palestinian resources. They enjoy economic and tax benefits from the Israeli government and have access to cheap Palestinian labor. Furthermore, they benefit from Israel's lax enforcement of safety and environmental standards. Therefore, settlement business representatives cannot be taken seriously when they claim to represent the interests of Palestinian workers. Our report adds, quote, settlement companies are responsible for their conduct towards Palestinians and should be held accountable. The Who Profits database provides an extensive overview of companies with businesses in settlements, including SodaStream, whose main production site is in Mishor Adumim, an industrial zone located in an illegal settlement in the West Bank. For more on the report by Who Profits, visit Adri Newhoff's post on our Rights and Accountability blog section at electronicintifada.net. And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Following sustained activism by boycott campaigners in Yolo County, California, multinational corporation Veolia has withdrawn its bid for a $325 million water project in Woodland and Davis near Sacramento. Although Veolia did not give a specific reason for their withdrawal from the Yolo County contract bid, it was reportedly the only company which withdrew from the bidding process. Members of the Davis Committee of Palestinian Rights stated in a press release that they had been contesting the participation of Veolia as a prospective bidder for 18 months and appeared before meetings of the Water Agency's Board of Directors with documentation of Veolia's history of profiting from Israel's occupation. Veolia and its various subsidiaries are involved in a number of Israeli projects supporting illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank, including the Jerusalem Light Rail and the Tovlan landfill. Boycott activists working to expose Veolia's ongoing involvement in Israel's violations of Palestinian rights and international law have successfully pressured local city councils across Europe and Australia to deny Veolia's contract bids. The company has lost billions of dollars worth of contracts over the past several years. In other news, gearing up for the Super Bowl, boycott activists have begun filming spoof advertisement videos for SodaStream as a part of an ongoing effort to expose the company's profiteering from Israeli colonization in the West Bank. SodaStream, a kitchen product that makes seltzer water, has bought a 30-second spot in a commercial break during the Super Bowl, which is the most watched television event in the United States. Advertisements during the Super Bowl can cost millions of dollars each. SodaStream products are made in the industrial zone inside the illegal Israeli settlement colony of Mishor Adumim in the occupied West Bank. A coalition of activism groups, including the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, is calling on activists worldwide to create their own spoof ad about SodaStream's activities and practices in time for the Super Bowl. For much more on these stories and other current news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, check out our activism and BDS blog on electronicintifada.net. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out the arts and culture features, our newest op-eds. Also, our readers send in photos and eyewitness reports documenting how Volvo bulldozers damage farms and uproot families. Aid workers urged to stop playing by Israel's rules in the West Bank. A subscription offer from Haaretz, the liberal Israeli newspaper, helps the Jewish National Fund, a charity implicated in ethnic cleansing, and much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.